February 11, 2008 will come to order, and we'll open the work session on House Bill 3619. Paul?
Mr. Chair, you have two amendments before you on House Bill 3619. They're kind of in reverse order in how we'll look at them. The dash 8 amendments is based on a work group meeting involving the chair and the vice chairs, and it changes the basic structure of the bill. It replaces the bill. And then the dash 7 amendments are an addition to the bill on an issue that you've discussed prior to the February session on expanding the cap on the Oregon Affordable Lenders Credit, Affordable Housing Lenders Credit. So what we'll do is we'll start with Chris on the dash 8s, and then I'll come back and talk about the dash 7s on the lenders credit.
Okay, great. I think, Chris, what we need to do is walk through these amendments, because I've seen them about a half an hour ago, but I don't think anyone else has seen them until just now. And I see LC is here, so we may want to hear from them about what they did, too.
Mr. Chair, I think that's a good idea. I've had it about half an hour myself, and so I've been reading through them.
Okay.
So however you'd like to do it. You just want me to start walking through it? The point that I...
That'd be fine with me. And if LC wants to come forward and be ready to talk about it would be helpful to us, I think. So I already have some questions, but I just assume hear how the bill is structured and what we've done to it. And I understand this is the gut and stuff. So it's if I've got that right, then we can ignore the original bill and just look at the dash 8s.
That's correct.
That's correct. Okay.
Okay, section 1 of the bill on page 2 pertains to criteria that the Department of Energy can establish by rule. And here, these are the criteria here, and you can see on lines 8 through 19, the bold material, are the criteria just for the renewable manufacturing facilities. So not for Betsy in general, it's just for these large production facilities. In lines 8 through 12, the sub B pertains to the standards and definitions of what constitutes a single renewable energy resource facility and property that would be included or not included in that facility. So it gives energy by rule the ability to be very clear about what is and is not part of a facility. Lines 13 through 15 pertain to creating standards for the minimum level of increased employment, and this was part of the discussion. It's kind of the economic development angle to these credits and what would be with respect to energy would be able to decide what is a significant level of employment. So not necessarily just one job, but however many jobs would be relevant for meeting the criteria of obtaining the credit. Lines 16 through 18 pertain to the financial viability of the applicant. There have been some cases where energy has received some applications for credits that didn't seem entirely credible. This just helps energy develop rules, gives them the authority to develop rules to look at that particular aspect to an applicant to see if they're legitimate or not, if you will. And kind of in connection with that is sub E, lines 18 through 19, it's the likelihood of long-term success of a facility. Basically, the goal here is to not have a company come in and get a large credit and then leave 2 years later. The Department of Energy will be able to look at the viability of the project and make a decision as to whether or not they're going to be around for a number of years, and so the state can get kind of that economic return on these credits. So those are the criteria that energy will be allowed to make. Section 2 pertains to the amount of the credit, and here under sub B, lines 27 and 28, the cap for these credits is $40 million per facility. And you can see that language is pulled out of sub A on line 25. So the new structure of the Betsy would be a $10 million cap for non-renewable projects. That's not changed. A $20 million cap for facilities using or producing renewable energy. That's not changed. But then for those companies that produce this resort, the renewable equipment manufacturing, it's a $40 million cap. And that's not a substantial change from current law in the sense that, I mean, well, the dollar amount changes, but under the current law, there's this aspect to the number of certifications that energy can issue. So right now, they're issuing up to 2 certifications per facility. So it moves away from this per certificate aspect and just lumps it together into up to $40 million. So before, it would be up to two $20 million certificates, and now it's just a single $40 million cap. Okay. Then moving on to sub 2, this allows the Director of the Department of Energy to grant lesser amounts under certain criteria. So not always, they don't always have to grant the $40 million. And those criteria are the A through E there on lines 4 through 19 of page 3. And the sub A, now these criteria had to be they had to be kind of fixed, and in terms of not respect to anyone's judgment, they had to be non-discretionary to abide by the uniformity provisions of the tax law. And the sub A there says that if the last forecast is less than 3% of the appropriations for the current biennium, then the director is allowed to issue a lesser amount of a certificate. The sub B pertains to the forecast, and if the current revenue projections are less than 2% of the forecast for the current biennium for the legislatively adopted budget, then the director can certify less than the maximum. Sub C there is, again, it gets at that likelihood of success. So if there's some sort of mix in terms of how successful they could be, the director can say, okay, well, you can't have a $40 million credit, but you can have something lower. The sub D is similar to the likelihood of success criteria. It's based on employment. So if a project can offer less employment than the standards established earlier in the bill, then they can get a lesser credit. And then E is the financial viability established before. It's that running with the same thing, at least as I read it, simply keeping there. So it's not an all or nothing deal. So you have we've had the criteria that DOR has established, and here it provides some benchmarks for when the credits can be offered and the extent to which they can be offered. Moving on to section 3. On page 5, it clarifies some language pertaining to the Public Utility Commission, and then clarifies that the director can consult with the Public Utility Commission if they're a relevant player in the applicant for the credit.
Right, so essentially we've dropped out the language that requires consultation on line 29 of page 4 and added the discretionary language on the top of page 5.
I believe that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right, that's a detail. Thank you.
And then section 4 pertains to what has been termed a clawback provision. And this is kind of as far as I was gotten in terms of reading the bill.
Yeah. So there's some problems with that section, too. Committees, I have a series of questions, and that may prompt some other questions for you, and maybe I'll direct them to Legislative Council. Dexter, does this deal with the ambiguity in the current law about the number of BETCs that can be awarded, and if so, how does it do that?
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Counsel, and with me is Kate Oswald, Deputy Legislative Counsel. It does that by granting the Department of Energy authority to, by rule, delineate what constitutes a facility and caps the maximum amount of credit at $40 million per facility. It does not create a total cap on the amount of credit that may be granted. The other thing I'd like to note just more as a clarification on what Chris was discussing, the credit can never exceed the cost of being applied for. So even if, there's a $40 million cap, but if you apply for a $30 million facility, that was, everything else is fine, you're only going to get a $30 million certification.
How does that hook with this? What you just said, how does that hook with this bill?
That's the way the credit works now. You cannot get a credit for more than the cost of the facility.
Well, with the line 21 on page 2, the total cost of facility.
Correct.
May not exceed. Line 23.
Correct.
Okay. When we're talking about the cost of facility, we're not talking about the credit, are we? The credit's half of that.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Explain how the revocation provision works, Section 3, I think it is. Section 4. I'm not sure this does exactly what we were hoping, but why don't you explain what this section is supposed to do?
For the most part, it does not change existing law. And that is that if the entity to whom a certificate was issued and who is operating or purportedly operating the facility, if they in fact are operating it in such a way that it ceases to qualify for the credit, the Department of Revenue, the Department of Energy essentially goes through a decertification process, revokes the certificate, notifies the Department of Revenue of that, and the Department of Revenue then collects the entire amount by which that entity had benefited from the credit from that entity. And that's the language essentially in on page 6, lines 2 through 13. The significant change actually has to do with what happens if a applicant, the person who initially receives a credit, goes and transfers the credit to some other taxpayer or group of taxpayers. And that language makes it clear that taxpayers who have purchased, in essence, have purchased the credit from the original applicant, they're not going to be affected by the revocation, in essence. Once there's a transfer, you cannot revoke the certificate.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Representative Rosenbaum?
Well, Mr. Chair, I may not be following this. It's Monday morning. But, Dexter, did I just hear you say that once the credit is transferred, which I think means the same thing as sold,
yes,
then the certification for the project cannot be revoked? I thought that was existing law.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, existing law, I think, is silent on that point.
Ah.
And
now, the existing law is actually set forth in the bill. In this
the existing law, the transfer section is not in the bill because there was no need to amend that.
But no, this provision, ORS 469.225, is actually set forth here with the proposed changes that you've suggested.
Yes.
Yeah, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm a bit confused too. Then this, if the certificate was transferred and the original applicant has ceased to comply with the conditions, the language here says that it can't be revoked. Does that mean? I think our intent was to hold the person who purchased the credit harmless, but to allow clawback to the original applicant. Is that happening? I'm a bit confused.
I don't think that does.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Do I have your point right, Mr. Chair?
Well, I think that was what our conversation was, but I don't think this language actually does
that. Yeah, that, Mr. Chair and Representative Reed, I think that is correct. I think it needs to be modified so that the transferee is held harmless, but nevertheless you can enforce the clawback against the original applicant.
That was my understanding. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Berger.
Thank you for that clarification. That was my intent. A question, Mr. Chair, of Dexter on page 3, this ABC, section 2, on two and page 2 and 3, that is the same language from the... Did you take the same, the quarterly economic forecast? Remember we discussed that that was going to be taken from Education Stability Fund language, and that is
yes,
the same language?
Mr.
I didn't go back and check, Dexter.
It is the same language. The same standards. The other one that isn't there, because it wasn't discussed, is levels of employment.
Because you can't.
Well, we could put that in there, but
yeah. I guess, Mr. Chair, for the committee, I'm trying to express that under discussion in the subcommittee was how can we get out of this if things are turning really bad, and so we use the same language that would be invoked if we were to go towards the Educational Stability Fund. In other words, if things are that kind of bad, then the Department of Revenue could hold off issuing these types of credits. You understand?
Yeah, essentially, this language places this in the hands of the director. One assumes the director is listening carefully to the governor, and if the governor doesn't want to spend money this way, the director won't do it. I'm not certain I understand why you need both A and B. Is there on the top of page 3? They're different, but in a fairly modest way, it seems to me, unless I've misunderstood the intent.
I think I understand.
Mr. Chair, this really just models the language in the education facility.
Okay. All right. I have parsed that in the past. I don't understand it this morning, but I have understood it in the past, so I'll accept that. Now, one other question on that subsection of Section 2. In your opinion, does this give the director the authority to allow a zero credit if any of these A through E apply?
Mr. Chair, yes, it does.
Okay, so if they're a fly-by-night and they don't have financial viability, he can just say no.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Yes, please.
That would be after writing rules as to what a fly-by-night is. Just wanted that on the record.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yes, it's tied to the rules that the department must write under
469.
Page 2, lines 16 through 19.
Yes. I just want to be sure that
right.
That was
I think that's important because I use a very derogatory term. There are many very reputable business people out there in the world who get enthusiastic about new ideas but aren't really ready to carry them through, and that's what we're directing this at, isn't it? Another question that I had, too, on the revocation, I think maybe we covered it. I think it's clear to me that we need to work some more on the amendment to section 4, ORS 469.225. And I think the language in lines 9 and 10 is ambiguous. I think I understand what you're getting at, but page 6. I think I understand what you're getting at there is the original certificate holder or the new certificate holder who happens to be the company that bought the company that got the certificate in the first place. But the way the language is written here, it could apply to somebody who bought the certificate for cash down the road, and I think some clarification of that might be useful as well. Obviously, if Company A built the plant, got the original certificate, Company B merged with Company A, and it's now the new holder, successor in interest, then that language should apply to them. But it shouldn't apply to Bank C, who bought their certificate for cash. It's a different that comes under subsection 5.
Correction, Mr. Chair. There isn't the notwithstanding language, I think, deals with what would otherwise be an inherent conflict between those two concepts. So if you are, in fact, a...
Well, I guess my point, if I may, let me interrupt here, is that the word that the transferred in line 19 is ambiguous when you start looking at line 10. If you mean transferred, you know, for... we know what we mean by it, but I don't think it actually says that.
Well, we'll take a closer look at it.
Okay. All right. I mean, there are two kinds of transfers that could occur. One would be when the whole company transfers, and another would be when you sell the credit, and that second situation is the one we want covered there.
Correct, Mr. Chair. I note that line 20 references ORS 469206, which is limited just to the transfer.
Ah, thank you. That may have taken care of it. Thank you very much. That comes with having not seen this very far in advance. And I want to say I really appreciate the work that you've managed to do over the weekend to get this to this stage. I know you've been working hard at it to try to get it to this stage. Other questions about the dash 8? Yes, no doubt.
Mr. Chairman, focusing again on page 6, lines 9, 10, and 11, is the idea that if they've transferred the tax credit to someone else and they receive cash for it, is that taxes in the sense that we're trying to collect with taxes back? Wouldn't be taxes any longer. Wouldn't it be the amount of money they now have? So how do we get that money back from them if they've sold the credit? They have the cash. They're not paying taxes. Let's assume they're losing money, yet they're not complying with the original idea of the
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, that I think is the Chair's point, that this language needs to be strengthened a little to ensure that you can get you can get at essentially whatever assets the transferor has to recoup the tax benefit that they've that the state is granting, but not from the transferee.
Mr. Chair,
please.
As far as security or something goes, we really don't have any. The money's back. The money's probably gone. Is the state just at the whim of the ability of this particular organization to have made money or kept it, is the better word for it?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, that's actually that's a policy question. If you wanted to, for example, in the provision authorizing the tax credit transfer, you could request some kind of security or something like that to be part of that transaction as well.
One final question.
Yes, sir.
Does the state have to approve the assignment of the credit? I've forgotten now. Is the state involved when that tax credit is sold? Does it have an opportunity to somehow check to see if they're still in compliance at the time of the sale of that credit? See if they're still in compliance with the original grant of the credit?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's the language is not as... for this particular transfer is not as formal as many of the other tax credit transfers that are allowed. The director of the Department of Energy is here, and he may be able to shed some light on exactly what process they go through with transfers.
Yes, it's probably not necessary for this today's purpose. It's just I just want to raise the issue, so in your crafting of it, it might be addressed if necessary. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dexter, I had a couple of questions about what the rulemaking authority would be on. I'm looking at page 2, I guess lines 13 through 15 about the increased employment, and then again lines 18 and 19 about likelihood of long-term success. My understanding is rules cannot exceed the statutory authority to write them, and these terms seem pretty vague. So how do you see this playing out in terms of what would be, for instance, the rulemaking authority to define what is the likelihood of long-term success? It seems like somebody could come in and argue that that would be a pretty minimal standard. Or a pretty vague standard, I guess. It just seems to open the way for a lot of arguing about the rules.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that is true. It is a fairly substantial grant of authority, provided that the rules have something to do with factors indicating long-term success, and perhaps what the department could do in justifying whatever rules they adopt is pointing to previous examples of facilities constructed somewhere in the world, and these were the factors that these were successful facilities, and these are, in the department's opinion, the factors that led to their success, that type of thing. But the standards here are, so provided the rules have something to do with long-term success of the facility, they can be whatever the department feels is appropriate.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
And so likewise, the minimum level of increased employment, as long as the rule related to a minimum level of increased employment.
Correct.
Okay.
Same set of issues. I think there, in fact, is a great deal of information available in the world, at least the business school would tell you, that there is, on whether or not a manufacturing facility and the company that owns it are likely to be successful or not based on their capitalization, the product they're trying to make, their business plan, and a whole bunch of other things. So I don't believe that the department's going to have to reinvent the wheel in order to figure those things out. And those apply equally well to this kind of a business as they do to pretty much any other kind of a manufacturing business. I think there's a lot of information out in the real world available for that. On the other question, we have left it pretty vague, and what I would suggest is that the point of this special session bill is to give a grant of authority to the department to write these rules. That doesn't mean, of course, that in 09 we don't come back and take a look at the rules they've written and say, no, we want it tighter this way, and write a statute that says that. This bill is either permanent because it doesn't have a sunset clause on it, on the bill itself, or it becomes temporary because we amend it next time. But in the meantime, it does mean that we can act in a way that gives somebody the authority to consider that issue before they offer tax credits. And I think that's the point of drafting it this way today. If we had a better standard in our own minds, then I think adopting that standard would make sense. I don't think we do. And if the representative wanted to suggest one, I'd love to consider it. Other questions? I have a couple more, but I want to make sure we've covered all of the ones that other members have, and unless mine jogs some. I notice on the current, in the existing statute, on lines 25-26 on page 5, the terms under which a revocation of a certificate can happen are that the certification was obtained by fraud or misrepresentation, or the holder of the certificate has failed substantially to construct or make every reasonable effort to operate the facility in compliance with the plan, specifications, and procedures in the certificate. Is that sufficient to deal with a situation in which people moving right along in accordance with their business plan, in fact the plan failed, and they were unable to comply with their undertaking, as in we're going to operate this plant for X years and we're going to employ a wide number of people, and then they fail to do that. Does this cover that situation?
Mr. Chair,
it doesn't appear to me that it does, simply because the ever reasonable effort language.
It does. My opinion, it would come close. We could bolster that. I do want to flag one other thing for you in this area.
Yeah.
Currently, you can only do this revocation, if you look over on page 6,
yeah,
line 2, based on fraud or misrepresentation. So this is an expansion of the scope with which they could do the revocation. Go beyond that. There certainly would be no legal problem if you wanted to tone down the every reasonable effort and just simply have it be that they're failing to operate the facility in a way that would continue to have it qualify as a facility.
Right. I mean, if a company came in, they started up operations, they received a certificate, then 6 months later, they ran out of money and closed. They presumably had not complied with the undertaking that they'd made with the department to operate for a certain number of years. If that were, and I guess what I'm thinking is that one of the ways of reducing the likelihood of that happening is to make at least the company strictly liable for that, rather than having a reasonable efforts standard. The other issue, which I think Representative Benz may have been referring to, is the issue of who it is that was on the hook for the failure. If the certificate's been sold, then the transferee, the new holder, gets the credit under this bill, and I think under any reasonable modifications we're thinking about. And it may be that the company isn't worth the amount of the certificate. So even if we foreclosed on the property, we may not recover our loss under the certificate. What about the possibility of holding directors and officers of the company liable for the failure to operate the company in accordance with the certificate? That's not in here at all. I don't know if that's what you had in mind, Representative Benz, but it's something that occurred to me as you were talking.
Mr. Chairman, my actual thought was that when the money comes into the company from the sale of the credit, would be the easiest way to make sure there would be money coming in from the sale of the credit,
mm-hmm.
And at that point, if the state had the opportunity to see if they were in compliance, the money would be there. Because it would be exactly right, as opposed to making directors and officers liable is challenging because of there's quite a bit of latitude within which they can operate under their business judgment rule.
Right. Thank you. All right. Well, you've got some suggestions about how to proceed. Is that something that you'd like to see? Is that Representative Benz, that there be a check at that time of transfer as to whether that the department be allowed to check at that point to see whether the company continues to be in compliance?
Yes.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, I think before we go too far down that road, I'd like to kind of hear from somebody as to whether that's workable. Because these are not sold, I don't believe. They're either sold right away or they're sold over time, and how big of a sale would cause a reissuance of certification, because they do go through a certification process in the first place,
mm-hmm.
before they can issue these credits. And I can foresee a situation where every time you try and go and sell a credit, you have to go through so much mishmash it isn't worth selling the credit.
Yeah.
And that worries me. So if we're going to go that road, I'd like to see some either thresholds or timing issues so that the company isn't constantly going through recertification with every credit, no matter how big. That's my worry on what we're talking about here.
It's
the workability of it. I mean, in theory, that's great, but...
Let me suggest that we ask counsel to work on subsection 5, lines 18 through 21 on page 6, and take a look at the every reasonable effort language on line 27 at page 5, and any potential ambiguities in the any successor in interest language on line 10 of page 6, the comment that I made earlier about that, and leave other changes for next year, if ever. Is that acceptable, Representative? I mean, because I don't, there may be, I mean, earlier in the bill, it may be other changes that we asked about. I'm talking about this portion of it. Because Representative Berger's comment is right on, we get into a complexity that we're not going to be able to deal with in the next day. Did you want to add something, Representative Berger?
No, only that I'm kind of reassured by this in sections, page 6, Section 4, this language about the assessment tax should be necessary. No statute of limitations shall preclude the collection of such. In other words, we can go after them with everything we've got by this language.
Yeah.
And which we could anyway, I think, without the language. I'm not sure that it's necessary.
Well, yeah.
Right. But if we can clean up the lines 9 and 10, we can go after their equipment. We can go after to get our money back, but I'm hoping this never becomes a problem, that the projects are vetted in such a way that it's win-win all the way around. I think we're...
Now, Mr. Grady is here, and he's going to issue certificates only to sound businesses that are going to carry out their undertakings, and this will never come up.
This will be a problem.
All right. Anything else on this piece of this bill? Thank you. You have your orders. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And now I'd like to move to the, is it dash 7? Dash 7 amendments. Right. Is that Paul? Is that yours? Yeah. Thank you. While he's coming up, colleagues.
Mr. Greener would like
to. Oh, do you want to talk on this issue a little bit? Yes, before we go on, Mr. Greener.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very briefly, Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy. First, again, thank you for working on this bill for us, because it does, I think, clarify and give us the legal authority we need to make this provision for manufacturing facilities work. I did want to mention two things. One, in regard to going back, if we had to recover financial payment, as part of our financial review and assurances, I think we could build in conditions, including, if necessary, a letter of credit or something as to a guarantee. We've done that on site certificates for energy facilities before, so there are ways of building in financial assurances if we have the legal authority, which this bill would give us. And then, secondly, there was one additional change that I think would be needed to make the bill work, and that's on page 6, down at the bottom on line 24 in section 5, where the phrase is, applies to applications for preliminary certification filed on or after January 1st, and that filed should be approved because we do approve, because we do have some applications pending that we'd like this bill to apply to.
So line 24 would say preliminary certification approved,
yes,
on or after January 1. You got that? Yes, he's got it. Okay.
Great.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
That's all I have.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Graney now? I expect he'll be back tomorrow.
I will. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
this is not a question for Mr. Graney, but maybe a question for Paul. And I'm going back in my notes on one of our previous hearings, that one of the reasons these credits need to be sold relates to the change in sales factor and the low tax liability of many corporations. And I guess my question is, with this provision that we are now going to modify so it does what we want it to do, if we are going back to the original applicant for these certificates to collect taxes which would otherwise have been due, would our ability to collect those taxes be limited to the tax liability of that original applicant? I mean, if part of the reason they had to be sold to begin with was because that applicant had little tax liability.
Mr. Chair, I think that's a good question.
I think it is, too.
I'm Chief Counsel.
And I think the intent was that we're talking about the dollars, not a tax liability as such. I mean, I think that's an excellent question, and I'd ask counsel to review this bill to see whether that actually applies. Now, you understand the question?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. Should we go on to sub 7? And maybe you should introduce it, Paul, and then ask the people who we asked to come to talk about it.
Okay. The dash 7, 3619-7, you should have before you. This amendment is not related to the business energy tax credit, but the relating clause in your bill is tax credits. And this is an issue that the committee had quite a bit of testimony on at your January 17th meeting. It was a proposal that came from the Housing Council, and we do have Housing and Human Services folks here, the directors here, and Assistant Director and John Fletcher, who we've been working with on these on this amendment. The amendment itself is pretty straightforward. It just, if you look on page 3, right at the bottom of the page, line 30, we currently have a cap, a fiscal year cap, on the amount of the affordable lender's credit that can be certified by the Housing and Community Services Department. That cap was increased from 11 to 13 million by the 2007 legislature. As you recall, the testimony you received is that that cap was reached very quickly after the session ended and the authority was granted, primarily due to an expansion of the kind of facilities in which the credit could be applied. In particular, an expansion to facilities that have federal subsidy, rent subsidies to the occupants. So that expanded the universe and increased the usage of those credits. The proposal is to increase that cap from 13 to 17 million. The department would be able to begin to certify those projects up to the higher cap in the second half of 2008, but the credit itself would not apply until the for taxpayers who received it, lenders, until tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2009, and that is on the very last page, page 6, section 28, which makes it clear that this will not, the expanded credits will not be applicable to tax years prior to January 1, 2009. And keep in mind that corporations have variable tax years, so many of them would start, for example, on July 1. So the credit would be used, spread over a number of tax years beginning at that point. I did put together a preliminary revenue impact statement for you. A lot of this, the impact explanation is based on the work that Housing and Community Services has done in terms of the impact, and they can talk with you about that. We do not expect any revenue impact in 2007-2009. In 2009-2011, the cap is increased to $4 million per year, but we estimate because of the utilization rate we see now of the credit, which is roughly 60% of the existing credit, in fact, there's been a sharp increase from 5 all the way up to $13 million in recent years, so there's a lot of these credits out there, and it's not a transferable credit, and it can be carried forward 5 years. And finally, one of the statements I have there is that the weaker the outlook for corporate profits, particularly this sector, the financial services sector, the more the credit you can anticipate being carried forward. So we're expecting a backloaded impact. Eventually, the revenue impact is we'll get to $4 million per year, $8 million per biennium. We don't expect that to occur until you get out to the 13-15 biennium. So that's why we've got a $3 million impact in 09-11, 11-13, we have a $6 million impact. If the economy is a lot stronger than forecast, we may see that credit being used a little bit more quickly. But given the outlook we have now, that's the anticipation we have. One final point about the revenue impact. As you know, our revenue impacts do focus on just the direct effects. We're just looking at how the credit affects the revenue stream coming in. And I know a key part of your decision is what the credit will be used for and what those effects will be. And again, working with the Housing and Community Services Department, they have estimated that the preservation work with the expanded credit should account for about $31 million annually in federal subsidies. Of course, this is income to Oregon residents in the state. And in addition, the loan activity, roughly $100 million for a $4 million increase in the credit, should generate about $9 million in additional construction activity over the next 2 years as these renovation projects go forward. Again, the department has done a fair amount of work on what the other secondary effects are, including some work on what the social costs may be, and I would ask them to come up and go through that with you.
Okay. Can I ask you a quick question? You've got in here 31, and Representative Greenlight, we're looking at this, you've got in here $31 million in federal subsidies, which are sort of come from the tax credit which we're offering, or which we already have. You say there you include, it's the full amount. Without that $4 million increase, do you know where we are in the subsidies, the federal subsidies?
Mr. Jordan, I don't know, but I think the Housing and Community Services Department would be able to address that. Those numbers came from their estimates of the progress.
Okay, so we'll hear from them now. And because of the way this room is set up, there's room all the way across anywhere where there's a microphone.
Good morning. My name is John Epstein, and I'm a member of the Housing and Community Services Oversight Committee. I want to thank the Revenue for hearing us again. I think we were in front of you about 2 weeks ago. What I'd like to just give a quick recap again of what we're asking for and the advantages. And also, what I'm going to try to focus on here is, I know in light of the recent budget that came out, you're all focusing on economics and dollars. And I think the advantage of what we're proposing here is there's an incredible amount of leverage that we're going to get out of these public dollars on the private side. And I think that's a real plus. To recap again, just real quickly, I'll just take 1 or 2 minutes. The tax credits right now allocated for the tax credits is $13 million. Last session, Oregon Housing and Community Services asked for an increase of $4 million, and you gave us $2 million. With that $2 million, what we did is we've been able to preserve currently, we're already working on or in our pipeline, 1,600 units of affordable housing throughout the state of Oregon. That's urban and rural communities. What is this affordable housing we're trying to preserve? Currently, throughout the state of Oregon, there are a number of affordable properties that had HUD Section 8 vouchers associated with them. Section 8 vouchers help our poorest residents throughout our community, which is families, disabled, and seniors, pay the rents on their apartments. Again, these properties are spread throughout the state. The Section 8 vouchers and this program are currently expiring. So what's happening is these units, these properties are coming out of use. So the people who currently own them have the right to sell the properties to somebody else and let this program go away. They can turn these into market rate projects, and obviously we go to market rate projects and we lose the subsidy, all the people in these projects will be displaced. And so what we're trying to do when we say preserve is hold on to these projects as affordable housing throughout the state of Oregon. Again, we're already working on, with that last allocation you gave us, 1,600 units. With this new request of $4 million in tax credits, for the current coming year, we've identified another 1,800 units that are at risk. And our proposal is to position those so we can acquire these from these private property owners and preserve them as affordable housing. Let's just talk about the economics and what this leveraging means on these $4 million in credits. The Section 8 vouchers we already talked about, those currently, if you look at those over the next 20 years, let me back up a minute. If we purchase these from these for-profit people and keep them affordable, what HUD will do is renew the Section 8 vouchers for 20 more years. If you let them go to market today, there's no guarantee that HUD will give you these Section 8 vouchers back. So there's a preference here that HUD is giving, and these are federal dollars, obviously. There's a preference you are getting on maintaining current projects if you don't let them go away. What does that mean to us economically in the state of Oregon? If you look at that over the next 20 years, those subsidies represent about $250 million in money from the federal government coming into Oregon. If you let these units go away, theoretically, or theoretically, if you wanted to keep these people in affordable units, that's potential over the next 20 years, $250 million the state of Oregon has to come up with instead of the federal government paying that $250 million. Let's also look at, if we let these units go away, what that means on a cost basis of new construction. If we acquire the current units and rehab them, do a little bit of rehab work in them, we're estimating it's about $65,000 a unit to acquire on the average, $50,000 to acquire the existing unit, $15,000 to rehab them and bring them up to a new standard. If you go out and build new units, it's going to be, you know, $150,000 approximately a unit to build brand new units. If you net that out over these 1,800 units, there's a potential saving of approximately $200 million of acquiring current units and maintaining them versus letting them current units go to market and having to build brand new units. So, again, you have $200 million savings on construction costs. You're preserving $250 million in potential Section 8 vouchers for these projects. So I think that's pretty compelling economics of not letting this money go away on us by preserving these Oregon affordable housing tax credits for $4 million. A couple of things important to note is the Section 8 vouchers, again, serve people who are really our lowest income residents. I mean, these are people who, you know, are living on Social Security, might be making $12,000, $14,000 a year as their total income. They cannot afford market rate rents, and the Section 8 voucher allows them to have decent housing. I think John's going to give a little more detail on this, but also there's the whole cost of social services. If these people are displaced from this housing, where are they going to go? You have to maybe give them rent subsidies. You might have to deal with homeless shelters. If there are elderly people providing senior services for them, if there are people coming, you know, perhaps off of abuse programs that are in this housing, find new homes for them, and perhaps that there's a back to abuse of drugs or something. So the social cost is very high also, and John will give some economics on that. I think one thing I want to say is I know really in front of you and your decision is really this, the $4 million for Oregon for the housing tax credits. Also, because there's been some confusion on this, there's also another proposal for another $2 million from the Oregon Housing Alliance. That $2 million is actually a general fund request, and why is that important? The Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits is a long-term fix for these. It provides a 20-year subsidy, allows you to leverage in private bank money. It was mentioned earlier that we're leveraging about $100 million in private bank money with these tax credits to help buy these projects. That's a long-term fix. These projects are coming up right now to be purchased. The long-term fix can take 6 to 12 to 18 months to put into place. We need a short-term fix immediately. And the $2 million general fund request is going into a fund that will leverage with foundation money. Some foundations have stepped up in the state of Oregon, also with bank money, to do immediate response to buy these projects, hold them for, you know, 1 to 24, 36 months until the long-term fix can be put in place. So the two proposals will complement each other. One is a short-term fix to make sure we hold on to these projects so they don't go to market, and the 4%, $4 million tax credit is the long-term fix. And then, John, do you want to speak to the Bill, do you want to speak for a minute?
Do you want to speak to the private leveraging first, Bill?
Sure.
Okay. You know, well, I have a question on the last point that you made. Given what you've described about the long-term versus the short-term, do we get our $2 million of general funds back after you've finished using them for the short-term fix, or where does that money go? This is a ways and means question, but I couldn't resist.
Chair Barnhart, John Fletcher with Oregon Housing Community Services Department. The $2 million is not something that we anticipate getting back. It's possible if this short-term fund pool does not work as anticipated that we can recover some of the costs, but it's not anticipated that we will be getting that back. It's to provide seed money to help leverage some of the trust money and the other private capital money. The $2 million essentially grows to a $50 million pool. But they want to see the state step up and show some support for them to step in and provide those other funds. So it's not like we get that back.
I will just add, you know, while we're talking about the immediacy of this right now, 1,800 units coming on in 2008 that we need to deal with, there are other similar projects coming out of the Section 8 vouchers over the next 4 or 5 years, and this response fund will be dealing with them. So it's really the fund is going to be in place for 5-6 years or even longer, dealing with immediate response for other projects coming out. But what we're trying to tackle right now is this immediate need to preserve 1,800 units in 2008.
Okay. So do you want to just real quickly emphasize the private?
Yeah. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Bill Van Vliet, and I'm the executive director with NOAA, excuse me, the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. And NOAA is a nonprofit consortium of Oregon banks that finances affordable housing projects throughout the state. Most of the projects that we have utilize the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit in our financing. And so really we can, I can speak to the fact that, every dollar of tax credit leverages $4 of private bank capital investment for the acquisition of these projects. It's a powerful leveraging tool, and effectively by having that lower price capital from the lower interest rate loan, it lets the banks on these preservation projects finance a bigger portion of the acquisitions, which means that there's a smaller gap down the road to finance that would otherwise have to come from public resources. So it really does a couple of things. It brings private sector capital to the table, and it brings a greater amount of it to the table than otherwise would be available. And we've seen this work time and time again for years, and it's been a very successful and powerful program. I think that's really, I'd conclude my comments there and just leave it open to questions beyond that.
Thank you.
Okay, Chair Barnhart again, John Fletcher from Oregon Housing Community Services Department. I wanted to provide an overview of what this credit means and what some of the impacts are at a glance. So Chris is handing out that handout, and I'll walk you through it, but it provides a pretty good summary of some of the different impacts that we anticipate under different scenarios. And I've outlined three scenarios here. If you look at the columns on this handout, the first column talks about an increase of the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit of $4 million plus a $2 million general fund appropriation that we've talked about. In other words, the full funding request that we've asked for. The second column outlines the effects of what would happen if the $2 million general fund was not provided and we only had the long-term resources without the short-term resources. And then the last column shows what happens if we do nothing. Okay. So looking at the units at risk, under each scenario, there's in 2008, there's roughly 1,848 units that we do not have sufficient funding to address. We have exhausted our resources, and those those particular projects are expiring, and we can't wait till 2009 to address those. So those are at risk. And the next box talks about performance measures. You want to hold us accountable for preserving units if you grant these funds. And we've tried to indicate what the different performance we might be able to feel confident about in the different scenarios. The first scenario, if we got full funding, we're still not 100% sure we can preserve all of the units for various reasons. There are some owners that are simply going to sell, and they don't want to deal with the HUD program anymore, and those may be lost. We hope to do better than this 85%, but it's new ground. This is a lot of units in a year that we're going to try to tackle. We have to do all the negotiations on a project-by-project basis. We've set a target of 85% that we feel we can be accountable for at least that, but we may be able to do better. Interestingly, if we don't get the $2 million together with the tax credits, the number of units we can preserve falls to 40%, not the 85%. There's quite a drop-off. I want to briefly explain that it's been said before that we need a quick response to be able to keep these people on their contracts so that we don't lose them, and that the long-term financing can take 12 to 18 months. Well, that's very true. And if I get funding from the committee for the tax credits, and I'm trying to show you what I can do with that, well, I have to show this column, because our effectiveness is going to depend on whether or not we really do fill the short-term preservation pool along with the long-term resources. And then, of course, if we don't get funding, all those 1848 units are at risk. Looking at the next box, let's talk about the economic impact just a little bit. Our Housing Council member, John Epstein, mentioned that there's two parts of this acquisition rehab, $65,000 per unit, $50,000 would be for the acquisition, $15,000 would be actual construction for the rehab part. And that $15,000 per unit has an economic impact, has a construction impact, and those construction dollars provide jobs, they provide income in the communities, and there's a subsequent direct and indirect impact from all that construction activity. This box that I laid out demonstrates some of that activity based on the units that we put down as performance measure targets. So in the first box, the rehab construction activity over 3 years of $23.5 million is the $15,000 per unit associated with those 1,571 units that we expect to preserve. And then that money turns over. We found the economic studies that we have done. And if you work that construction and economic activity through the system, you know that that increased economic activity will eventually come back to be realized in terms of state revenue. And Mr. Warner indicated that they don't show those effects. We anticipated just really roughly what that might be at 6% of the total construction activity and over the five-year period, that's a $49 million construction activity, and 6% of that is roughly $3 million. But those would be in the early years, because all the construction happens at the first when these units are rehabbed. And that's important to realize, because the tax credit isn't going to be taken until some of the later years, but the economic activity happens right away. So as the state of Oregon is facing an economic downturn or slowdown in 2008, the nice thing about this proposal is that it does have some of these economic activity benefits in 2008, 2009, in these early years. Looking at the federal subsidy, as was mentioned, over 20 years we have almost 1,571 units, almost $230 million. That's money that stays in the state and is being spent and turns over to. I didn't know quite how to estimate the economic impact of saving $230 million in state, but I took, just for your reference, 6% of that, and you can see that over the course of the 20-year federal subsidy, that that's, again, a substantial amount of money. And you can see also how much is not saved if you look at the different other proposals. Looking at the social cost, this morning we got a little bit of data back from Department of Human Services. We estimated for them the number of people displaced under the different scenarios. It's about 2.4 persons per household was the estimate. And we estimated, given that these are Section 8 housing, that we have about 45% of the units dealing with the elderly, 15% with developmentally disabled, 15% are dealing with substance abuse, and then we have others that are just dealing with families with children or even individuals. And given those displacements, based on the units that were at risk that were not preserved, we had DHS estimate what the costs associated would be in terms of their increased caseloads, increased program costs, and so forth. And these costs are a per-year estimate that they gave us, and they range from $553,000 with the full funding to $9 million per year if nothing is done, if that many people are really displaced. And again, these are broad estimates. We've not been over this ground before and had so many projects at risk all at once. It's hard to say what's going to happen for sure. This is somewhat of a worst-case scenario, I think, in that all these people are going to be out on the street or impacted in a severe way. They tried to account for the fact that many of these people are already working with DHS, and so that's part of their estimate. But there will be some additional DHS costs, a social impact, if we are unable to preserve these units. And then finally, the last box that's shown on this sheet shows the estimated replacement costs for the units that are not preserved. If you remember Mr. Epstein's testimony, he said about $150,000 for a new unit. That could range up to $190,000 on the replacement costs. There's various reasons why the cost is high, but I don't know if you want to go into that. But there's significant replacement cost issues, and they go up if these units are not replaced, as well as the amount of federal rental subsidy that is lost. So on this page, you kind of get a feel for some of the magnitude of the different revenue issues, social cost issues, and replacement cost issues.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Grimm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And John, it's good to see you again for the everybody's consideration. John and I worked together back at First Interstate, right, which was many, many years ago. So it's good to see you, as always.
You're not old enough to have worked there,
right? Well, I was very young when I worked at First Interstate.
Child labor.
Yeah, it's a child labor issue. It was
an elementary school account.
Right. My question is just a simple one. It was the question I was asking Paul, and I think you answered it. I just want to make sure I'm comparing apples to apples here. You mentioned the $250 million in federal subsidies. The little cheat sheet we have says that this extra $4 million tax credit gets us $31 million in extra in federal subsidies. So obviously that's a pretty good return on investment. I want to know what we're getting right now for the $13 million that is part of the tax credit. Is that $250 million you referred to?
No. It's two different things. But we currently have $13 million out in affordable housing tax credits, which are leveraged into a number of properties. And that one, I don't know, the $250 million really is today at risk. There's 1,800 units at risk coming out of the HUD program. Okay. Those, if you look at those units, they today are generating in the low teens in subsidies from the federal government.
Right.
So if you take that number, obviously, even if you say it was $10 million a year in federal subsidies coming in, rent subsidies today, those are at risk of being lost if these projects aren't preserved.
Okay.
$10 million times 20 years, the subsidy is a 20-year subsidy, that's what we lose, is $200 million. So it's really like $12 or $13 million a year, and that's how I get up to the $250 million. Okay. So we already have a bunch of units we already have preserved. Many of those have Section 8 vouchers, some do not. What's unique about this portfolio is it has a very high percentage of Section 8 vouchers on it, higher than we usually see. And we will lose those if we don't preserve these units. And that's a huge loss of federal money coming into the state right now, which, in my experience with HUD right now, they're cutting back. But the kind of vouchers they are not cutting back on as much are property-based 20-year vouchers. So if we can get these renewed, we have a lot of assurity to keep this going for 20 years versus some of us have vouchers annually. Those are at risk of being lost. So this is where it preserves a big federal chunk of money coming to our state for the next 20 years.
Thanks, Sean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Broom, if I could just add a little bit to that. The Oregon Affordable Tax Credit used to be at $11 million, and we used to use that for new construction kinds of efforts. We would combine that with other resources and bond money and grant money. It's a recent thing that we've been allowed by law to use this on preservation projects. Only in the 2007 session was the law changed that allows us to use these on federally subsidized projects. And so we've gone from 11 to 13 and had a $2 million increase. We've used that $2 million increase largely for the preservation, and that's how we got to our 1,600 units in the pipeline right now. And so if you're trying to look at how all the $13 million has been used, it goes for more than preservation. It goes for the affordable housing development in every community throughout the state. But it also is going for the preservation projects that we've talked about, those 1,600 units.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I definitely support this, and I think that you're doing a good job of laying it out. I did want to ask, and I hope I didn't ask this question the other day, and I'm asking it again, but the federal subsidies for rental assistance, are those secure subsidies that are not going to go away in light of the federal budget deficit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, the renewals of these contracts, when they are for 20 years, will be solid. They'll be in place. Interestingly enough, if you look at the president's budget that was just released and look at the HUD elements of that, the president's budget fully funds the renewal of these Section 8 contracts, whereas some of the other pieces are facing cuts and reductions, and on a year-to-year basis, there's a little more uncertainty with that. But one thing they've been pretty good at is funding the renewals. And so renewals can take different forms. They can be 1 year, 2 year, or 5 years, or 20 years. And that's the real advantage of being able to secure the long-term contracts, because then we can have that assurity that they're going to be having that federal subsidy over a 20-year period. And that's what we're trying to do here with these units.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, may I just add real quick? For the record, Rick Craig, I'm the Deputy Director of the Department. I'm sure my boss is back there saying, you know, I can never shut my mouth in a meeting, so I had to come up and say just a few comments. First of all, to Representative Rosenbaum's question, that's a very good question, and certainly what we've been able to find with the units that we've been working with so far is there's a 20-year commitment. So as John said, it's pretty rock solid. Now, obviously, we never can predict what's going to happen with the federal government in terms of federal appropriation. There is always the right if the federal appropriation were to dry up or something to that effect, that could be at risk. But what we've seen is 30 years of success in terms of these contracts, and we've never had any issues in terms of those renewals. So I would say at this point that investment is a very secure investment. I also wanted to just real quickly respond to Representative Broome's question. Keep in mind, and I think John covered this very well, that when we made the change last session from 11 to 13, we also made another significant change, and that was to allow the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit to be used in conjunction with federally subsidized housing projects. So we were, as many would say, in a new ball game in terms of being able to preserve these type of projects. One of the things I did want to point out to you, and I think has been said a little bit already, but we've gone to work and we've preserved over 1,600 units. What that equates to in a federal subsidy at this point, $260.9 million is what we've been able to do. So that gets to your question of how much federal subsidy have we been able to do with the existing dollars.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, a comment and a question of you, actually a process comment before we go on, and I know you want to move on. I have to say that I, too, support this. I think that it's penny wise and pound foolish not to increase this, because affordable housing is not getting more affordable as we go forward. On the contrary, it's getting harder and harder, and preserving existing units makes all the sense in the world. The question then is, the comment is, but we are basically obligating next biennium by doing this, and I think we need to be eyes open when we do this. Okay, the question is then, or the comment is, the process here. We've got two proposals. This one we are putting under this bill because of the relating clause. The other one is coming out of the Senate, the $2 million ask, I understand.
That's the Ways and Means Committee.
Is it coming out of Ways and Means Senate? So does this bill then go to Ways? My question then is, does this bill then go to Ways and Means? It goes directly to the floor.
This bill goes to the floor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. I just wanted all this to be kind of on the record.
I mean, there are a number of choices that get made because of the way in which we deal with money. This bill is a revenue side issue, and so it goes to the floor, and on the other side, I presume it would go to the Finance and Revenue Committee. The other bill goes to the Joint Ways and Means Committee, the other issue, and it will be acted upon. If it's a Senate bill, it will get acted on the Senate side first. I think that overall, what I need to do is coordinate with the co-chairs of the Ways and Means Committee on the issue, and if the committee has a preference for how to what ought to happen, I think that's something that we need to make sure that the co-chairs know about as they do their work. My intention at this on this bill is that because of the rating clause, the Betsy credit that we worked on just a minute ago and this one would go in the same bill, and hopefully we get it out tomorrow after the other piece is fixed, and then send it over to the Senate, assuming that it passes the House first. But we don't have any control directly as a committee over whether the general fund allocation is made or not.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to know that on the record.
Thank you. That's very good. Anything else now? We will have an opportunity to look at this again tomorrow as we, because we have to look at the Betsy piece. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, I just wanted to walk you through really quickly this other handout that was just placed before you.
If you can do it very, very quickly. We have another bill we'd like to get to this morning.
Okay.
Enough so that people can review it and ask their questions tomorrow. That would be helpful.
Okay, fine. The first page indicates, based on the economic impact and the federal subsidy preserved and those dollars same as the state and how that rolls back into state income, we actually anticipate in the early years a positive revenue impact for 2008, 2009, 2010. And then, as Mr. Warner expressed, then we'll see the negative revenue hits of the tax credit being taken. But I just wanted to point that out. When you actually look quarter by quarter, when things will be submitted, when the tax credit will be allocated, when it will most likely be taken, and so forth. Again, it's an early economic gain and then subsequent revenue loss with the tax credit. But I just want to point that out and be happy to answer a question on that tomorrow if you want to take some time to look at that.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
We appreciate that very much. And we'll close the work session. What's the bill number?
3619.
We'll close the work session on 3619, House Bill 3619, and we'll open the work session on House Bill 3618. And I think that's Mazin's bill, is it? What we do. There were three amendments that should be ready for us. Colleagues, it's my expectation we're going to run up right up to the vapor edge of noon in order to just address the initial issues on this bill. And our three amendments have been distributed. Let's distribute the dash 1, dash 2, and dash 3 amendments. And we'll let Mazin describe what we're dealing with here. Yeah. Well, he's getting ready. Let me just say that I've looked at this thing and on the page, the definition sections, I think, are the same. But what are different between the dash 1, dash 2, and dash 3 is the tax table.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
So if you read one of them, you'll have everything except the tax table part, and then the others, we'll look at the tax table. Mazin, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the issue of the estate tax. As you remember, there was several meetings on this, and we had a Friday work group meeting in the Capitol Annex. This is where we live at this time. And in the meeting, Mr. Chair, you were, of course, present, Vice Chair Reed, and Representative Benz, and his cousin, too. And then we had Representative Hunt, Representative Krieger, and Representative Boone. Also, there was Legislative Council, Department of Revenue were present, and then probably more than one room should have of lawyers were also at the same time other interested parties, and the CPAs also were representing the CPA groups. And there was a discussion about what kind of things we were looking to improve with the bill. And these three amendments basically represent what we were trying to accomplish out of that. The amendments that we brought together, and why we have three, as you said, we have three different tables. The different tables that we have represent primarily, the first thing is how the credit table or the credit proposal represents itself. And I also included in your packet a graph that kind of looks like this graph here, and those are representative of how steep the reduction from the top of $7.5 million down to the $15 million credit schedule would go down. But quickly to go through the amendments, if we go through one in the language, you would probably get what all these amendments are trying to do. First of all, we're in the first page, and we're reading in the dash one amendment. It starts the redefinition. One of the most things in line 18. If you go down to 5 in the dash one amendment, the line 5 starts the definitions that have evaded us for a while, which is a definition of what the commercial fishing is. So this is a new definition for commercial fishing and what kind of property included within that definition, and that pulls on two things, on Internal Revenue Code and also on other suggestions that have brought forward. The amendment goes on the first page, line 16, to go through what the other, line 15 and on, to what the different properties included that are in that definition of farm and forestry. And in that, you remember there was a discussion whether the trees are in and what kind of improvements and whether the investments and the capital of the farm and so on. So these, all the way down to the end of the page, try to identify all these timber, trees, crops, harvesting equipment, working capital of a farm, natural resources, and so on. The second page of the first of the dash one shows the primarily the main segment of this page is the new credit table that is to replace the credit table that is included in the original bill. And the difference between those two tables, if you go to the original bill, if you have your bill file on the second page, we had two segments of the bill. One would give you credit up to $7.5 million in an addition, and then a subtraction when it comes to the $7.5 million down to the 15, or up to the 15 million. This page takes a different way of doing it by including all the amounts in one way of doing it. Basically, you take where the value of the property is, and on line 3 this is the amount of credit, and then the difference between line 2 and line 1 will be multiplied by the percentage in line 4 to add to your credit on line 3.
this is the way the income tax tables also work, so and this is the way the tax tables work for the state tax today. Now, continuing on page 3, many of the citations here, especially in line 8 and 10 and so on, includes the domestic partner language that was mentioned a few times. And then on line 16, these are some of the lines that I could explain very, very clearly. It says in line 24, delete the colon and insert the comma. That legal language is one of my specialties. I came up with that, Mr. Chair.
So, I'm not sure you want to take credit for it. Like, you may if you like.
Finally, in the line 22, you have the property, the issue of the conservation contribution put into language, which says that basically if you have that, then there is no recapture process. The line 43 is cleanup of the definition of how is the credit allowed and recapture of tax. And finally, we have the deletion of some of the lines on the last page of the original bill, where it talks about the inheritance tax return, whether how it is filed and when it is effective and which date. Now, Mr. Chair, for all these definitions, we also asked Legislative Council here is to work with us. Department of Revenue, W. Buchanan also worked with us all through the weekend to bounce these issues back and forth. However, the one thing I need to bring back to your attention, there was an idea of if we go up to $7.5 million of what the tax liability is, and then come down to $15 million in credit with that transition in order to avoid this cliff effect. There was an interest in finding out how different steepness of the curve, if you will, would affect the revenue impact, in the sense of we are trying to look for the lowest amount possible of that revenue impact. And in that table that I have for you both, it shows a different levels of steepness, and it shows a different amounts of revenue impacts that possibly could be out of these different curves. Now, keep in mind that what we have here is we have the total, which means that includes all the language that exists today, meaning that this is not the difference between what current law is as we put it and the new law, but out of this whole concept of the exemption that we are trying to replace by credit. So what you've seen, the first three lines, you've seen those before, the first four lines, in the paper that we've handed you before about these different amounts of impacts. The new assumptions basically put one of the new assumptions is the forward look of the 5 to 8 years in the amount, the number of years before, rather than only after. So we have now 5 to 8 years of being the same type of property, both before death and after death, in order for it to qualify. And then going down from the 75% of the total estate value to 50%, that's to be consistent with your wishes and also with the federal code. And in those we have the dash one, the 1, 2, 3 correspond to the dash 1-2 and dash 3 in the amendments, and primarily those are annual amounts that we have. So 1 million for the for the dash one, and that is the more, if you will, the more balanced, the more it comes down in the same steepness that it goes up.
Symmetrical?
More symmetrical.
Thank you.
Last year, that's the word that was escaping me. But again, it's...
That's the dash one?
That's the dash one.
Yes, okay.
The dash one is the most symmetrical of all three lines, if you will. But it's cut because it the tax table starts at 200,000, then goes to 500,000, then starts climbing in a million. So in order not to put it in a scale that is deceiving, I cut it to allow the scale to continue to be representative of what the fact is. The dash two, because it goes steeper, you're looking at slightly less amounts of about 0.87 in the annual average. And with the biennial works, there is the assumptions of in the beginning you would have very small amounts, then the people taking exemptions on the 10 months type of application allowance and so on. So you won't get until 11-13 where you have a full impact of a full biennium for all the those amendments. And as you see, the dash 3, which is the steepest decline, the steepest descent in the line, is at about 0.77 or 1.54 by the time you get to 11-13. That's what we were able to put together over the weekend, Mr. Chair, Council, and Department of Revenue, and we'll take.
Thank you. So that sort of now one question I had to make sure I understand the table. This is the average, the cost that you've described on the table. Is this starting from the beginning, or is this in addition to the amounts estimated on the statute we adopted last year?
No, that's inclusive, Mr. Chair.
Includes all of those amounts. Okay. Thank you. That's
so that's it's not in top off.
That's helpful. All right. Questions or comments on this one? I did note as I looked at this definition that one of the issues raised by the Farm Bureau and others, I think, was the issue of equipment which is not attached to the ground but actually moves, so it's not real property. And I noticed that in the definition section on line 19, it refers to forestry and harvesting equipment. Maybe I should ask counsel to come forward and we can talk. I'm sort of talking, thinking out loud here, and maybe you can help me read this bill. But as I recall, one of the issues we were talking about was to make certain that farm equipment was actually covered. And, of course, the farm equipment is what we were thinking about was equipment that's generally used in farming business. And in this case, it's actually used in the farming business. That could include things that you use to prepare the ground before you plant the crop. It could include trucks that are used to haul things around. Could include all kinds of things. I'm wondering how that got included in these definitions. Perhaps you can help us with that.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Kate Tossel from Legislative Council. Chair Barnhart, I believe as this draft has developed, the use of the definitions has been one of the main concerns. And as the definitions have been generated, I think there's a tension between trying to have a list of all included items so that there's clarity and getting to the point where the list is inclusive enough that by its nature anything that's not specified is not included. And the definitions that we have, basically the three types of property,
yes,
farm, forestry, and the commercial fishing property, this is developed over time. And I believe that If you look at subparagraph C on line 15, tangible and intangible personal property devoted to use as farm purposes, that's the intention. That's where we were trying to go with this. I believe that this set of definitions captures everything that the work group has tried to get to without resorting to using a site, which I believe at points we really just tried to tie it either to another statutory provision in the ORS or to Internal Revenue Code provisions. And so that tangible and intangible personal property was to get to that issue.
Just a quick suggestion. Could we add to that rolling stock, or would that be too broad?
I'm not sure I know what rolling stock is.
Rolling stock is equipment that moves.
Okay.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bruin, I'm certainly open to suggestions as to how to improve this list or whether to try to limit it in a way that it's perhaps more effective.
One suggestion that I was thinking of is replacing the word harvesting with farming. So it would say forestry and farming equipment. I don't know whether that deals with the issue or not, but it might.
Chair Barnhart, that may in fact do that, and I think what you see is the end product of a sort of committee of a definition by a committee, and hopefully we're approaching a point where
we're getting closer.
We capture everything we need to without making it too so vague or so inclusive.
Well, you certainly on lines 15 and 16, you certainly established the definition that we were trying to get to, which to cover all of these things, as long as we're not excluding things by the three I things that you've got down here. If those don't lead to exclusions of other things, then I think we're okay.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, the other thing I would notice to the entire section, ORS 118-140, there is rulemaking authority for the Department of Revenue. So as for the definitional part of this and the implementation of it, they do have authority under this section. So if there are refinements that are needed, there is rulemaking authority.
There is. Okay. Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When the rules are made, I assume that will allow the definitions to be narrow enough, for example, that it would not include all property on a farm or a forest property or a fishery that was not directly related to the operation.
Representative Gelser, Chair Barnhart, I believe that's correct to the extent that it fits within. It can't be inconsistent with the Internal Revenue Code provisions, and I think the intention is that it would be congruent with the purpose of the Act. There wouldn't be equipment that fell within this definition and that should by its nature be excluded.
Mm-hmm. So the race car track would not be included?
Exactly, as farming property devoted to the, and I think the word devoted actually does capture some of this, devoted to use as farm property.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That actually was specifically my question.
I thought it might be. Thank you. Yes, Representative Benz.
Chairman, am I correct in understanding that paragraph B, which says including, and then also paragraph C, both on page 1, which ends with the word including, concludes without saying the words but not limited to? Is that right? It's not a specific list, as Chair Barnhart already noted.
Representative Benz, Chair Barnhart, yes, I believe this, in terms of statutory construction, there might, if it's including, sets out what is within the definition, but it's not limited to. Generally, we would draft either as limited to or including, one or the other.
Sure. Just two more points. On line 9, it says boats, gear, equipment, other property used to process. Does process include catch? Or should the word catch be there in front of process?
Representative Benz, I believe some of these questions may start to venture into a technical area that I'm not entirely comfortable with it. I believe during this process, the definition of commercial fishing and the property that should be included in a way has been one of the most challenging aspects of this, and where the line between processing and catching lies, and maybe obvious to some. I'm not sure that it is.
Well, it might be helpful if we had copies of the Internal Revenue Code section 1301 sub B sub 4. That might help, and then Representative Benz could review that and see if he liked it or not. Because that may take care of the issue, or it might not, in which case we'd have to look at it some more.
I'm happy to do that, Mr. Chairman. Just one last question. I'm finished the line 18. Does crops include livestock? Is livestock supposed to be included? I've not been party to the discussion, so I'm not clear if livestock's included in this.
Representative Vance, it's a very good question. Again, that I believe that tangible personal property would include livestock, but I'd welcome any further refinements that we can reach.
As long as we're working on the definition section, that might be something to consider. Yes.
One of the things that the group have worked with and counsel, and I think and assumed in a lot of the work here, that if there is a definition for any of that stuff in the Internal Revenue Code, that definition is the one that carries and applies, unless we have to introduce something as a new definition. And that's where we give the Department of Revenue the rule-making authority of that definition. That's on the last page of the bill in House Bill 3601, 3618, as it says on line 7, the Internal Revenue Code as amended, and the Department of Revenue shall adopt rules consistent with those adopted under the Internal Revenue Code. So when the Internal Revenue Code is deficient, that's where I think the interjection counsel that is coming in.
Recognizing that the code provisions are really often intended to deal with some other issue, the department is going to have to stick with the issues raised in this statute. Yeah, and you had a response to that as well, I think.
Well, just to get back to the issue of the property, I believe as it's worded now with the either dash 1, dash 2, or dash 3 amendments, we do have both the real property and then tangible personal or intangible personal property. That is, it's quite inclusive, and I believe that the issue of the commercial fishing properties and the commercial fishing businesses and the concern about getting away from businesses that involve fishing but that were not part of the intent of this measure, I think this does capture it. We have real property and the personal property listed, and as has been pointed out, including does not suggest that there is not other property that is within the general definition and that is also covered.
Thank you. I had one other topic, a different topic, and I want to just make certain that we didn't get away from ourselves here. On the top of page 2, we have the three elections that are described, capital A, capital B, and capital C. I just wanted to make certain that this doesn't allow a decedent's estate to qualify for the credit when by claiming a partial credit. When by claiming a full credit, they don't qualify at all for the credit.
Your Honor, members of the committee.
And it may be because I don't understand the structure of how the pieces of the bill fit together completely.
I believe if you look at page 3 of the printed bill and you look at subsection 3, which is beginning on line 8, there are the restrictions for claiming the credit. The printed bill has the 75% threshold.
Oh, and we changed that in another portion of the amendment.
Right. In the amendment, right. All three, dash 1, dash 2, and dash 3, would change that to at least 50% of the total adjusted gross estate. There was a discussion of taking it off the adjusted as opposed to the the total.
Okay.
And the decedent's estate would need to meet that requirement. They could then go on to decide that they weren't going to take the credit at all, even if they did meet the requirements, or take less than the total value, or again, and this came out of the work group last week, to claim it on an asset-by-asset basis. And you see on line 4.
I see.
Claim it only for certain assets, and that I think also ties into the new recapture provisions, where if they then sold part of it or didn't continue to use it, the tax due on those certain assets would then be recaptured.
Okay, let me just walk through it and see if you agree with what I'm saying. As I understand it, what we're doing now is in these amendments is we're setting up a set of definitions. And let's suppose that the student's estate has some property which falls into these definitions on page 1 of the amendment. Any of the amendments, they're all the same, I think. So we'd consider that first. And then we'd go to subsection 3 on page 3 of the bill, and we decide whether or not the total value of the property for which the credit established under the section is at least 50% of the adjusted gross estate.
Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
yep.
I did have a question about what the change to adjusted actually does.
That would be a great one. We went through that in some detail at the work group meeting, but would you explain that?
I would. For some of these questions about the actual workings of this, I might defer to the Department of Revenue. I think I can address them, but I believe they might have a clearer understanding of that.
Well, as I recall it, the gross estate might include property which is encumbered at its full value, including the encumbrance, whereas the adjusted gross estate would just subtract the amount of the encumbrance. So if you had a mortgage on the farm, for example, the adjusted gross estate would consider the value of the farm minus the worth of the mortgage that you, in fact, don't own, gross estate, I'm not sure what the language is here, the total gross estate would include the value of the mortgage. And I think the point that was made at the work group meeting was that a portion that's encumbered, the encumbrance itself, isn't really a part of the value of the estate. So the adjusted gross estate is the correct measure rather than the total gross estate. I think that was the explanation.
That is my understanding, and I believe that's the main item that would be taken off the top to arrive at the adjusted gross estate. And I believe there's also...
And if I have a $5 million estate, but I owe $1 million to somebody as a part of it, it's actually only worth $4 million. And that's the point of it.
And I believe also in terms of the interaction between the federal state law and the Oregon inheritance tax, it's the adjusted estate that you'll be looking at.
And it is the adjusted estate that Oregon looks at, taken off of the federal estate tax return. Is that right?
Yes. That is my understanding.
Thank you. So the number we start with in our return is the adjusted gross estate.
Yes. And but this percentage will be out of that. Below the line,
not
that adjusted number.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Representative?
I think so.
Thank you. As I was going along then, first we'd figure out a definition. We figure whether we have any property fits within the definition. Then we go to the second phase and figure out whether it meets the conditions on sub 3 on page 3 of the bill. And then, after all that's done, we decide whether we want to take any of the credit or not.
That's my understanding.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I was not in the work group, thank goodness.
It was an interesting exception.
There are some things you don't want to volunteer with, but I know that there was a lot of discussion around the phase material participate, and in these amendments, I don't see, or maybe I'm not reading, we were going to define it in some way, and did we ever, or what did the group do with that?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, I have to say at the end of the meeting with the work group, everybody held hand and spontaneously broke into singing Kumbaya.
The
hearing
participate? Yeah, okay.
The material participation issue came, it was whether it is defined for one group and it's not defined for other group. And I think the idea came that the when it's defined is in revenue, internal revenue code, that should do. And if it's when it's not, and that was the problem, then the rulemaking authority by the Department of Revenue should be able to make that definition.
And where does it say that? Yeah?
Where does it say that?
That is in primarily this blanket, Department of Revenue shall adopt rules consistent with the, that's on the page, on page 4.
Of the original bill.
Of the original bill.
Got it.
And the material participation, as it was looked at the Internal Revenue Code, it's really not that.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I've been informed I'm giving the flag salute, so I cannot be late. Or somebody else will have to salute the flag for me. But I have one other question that I think that I would take to a meeting with Mazin and figure out how he came to these figures, because for the life of me, I don't know how he derived them. And that is a discussion that's going to take a lot longer than we've got today.
Yes, thank you. May I say that we will be looking at, I think that several of us have questions that we need to answer. I have some time this afternoon. I'll be working on some of them. If you want to get the questions to me, please do. I'd like to kind of be the conduit for most of them, so that we can try to keep this thing more or less in order. If we need a further amendment, that would be helpful to have sometime this afternoon. I am hoping that we will be in a position to actually adopt an amendment and pass out this bill tomorrow. I know that's a tall order at this point, but I'm hoping that that's what we're going to get to, and I'm seeing some head nods in the audience today. We also may want to address the other bill that we did not address today and hear from Legislative Council about that bill, the one relating to the disconnect. Also, of course, we hope to adopt the Betsy Dash housing credit bill tomorrow as well. So we have a full meeting scheduled for ourselves. Any further comments? If not, we will close the work session, and we are adjourned.